This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 249, was recorded on December 10th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium. 17 states have now joined Texas in petitioning the Supreme Court to overturn various states' election results and turn over selection of electors to those states' legislatures. But Safe Harbor Day has already passed, and exactly as we predicted here on Macro Voices, the dispute over contested election results is escalating into the December 14th final meeting of electors. That's next Monday. But something else that was predicted almost 4 years ago on Macro Voices was that President Trump might have aspirations of starting his own television news network after leaving the White House. That prediction was made by former presidential advisor and best-selling author Dr. Pippa Malmgren. So we brought Pippa back for an update this week on what she sees next for Donald Trump, assuming his attempts to overturn the election results are unsuccessful. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck will focus on the question, pause, correction, or crash.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500, because for almost 2 weeks, every day, we were just crawled a little bit higher. And for yesterday, we had our first big reversal day. Well, it wasn't even that big, but it was certainly the first reversal day. We'll talk more about it in the postgame, but what's your take on what's going on here in the markets?
Well, I think maybe we're finally seeing just a tiny little bit of awareness of reality here that, yeah, the vaccine news is great news, but, you know, that's next year's news. And this news right here, right now, today, is we see a very dramatic escalation in infections, in hospitalizations, and in deaths. And as much as there is a light at the end of the tunnel, it's not here yet, and we got some tough times ahead of us. The stock market seems to finally have noticed that, but frankly, I mean, you're the technician in the house, Patrick, but I don't see this as any significant correction or concern for you know, the sky is falling. It looks to me like just a tiny little hiccup and one that's long overdue.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because the dollar continues to stick to the bottom end of its range, doesn't seem to have any ability to hold on to any short-term rally. You still think that we have another leg lower coming in the dollar on the short term?
I think that we probably do, but I think we're going through a phase transition here. As Jeff Snyder has very correctly argued, the old style of QE really was not going to bring about the dollar crash that a lot of people feared. I think the market is smelling out that we've got a whole new kind of money printing on the horizon that is going to be inflationary, that is going to be destructive to the dollar, and I think it could be the beginning of maybe a very significant move lower.
All right, well, let's touch on crude oil here, because I'm a little surprised after that news that we're heading higher. I mean, I'm still long crude, but it's certainly a surprise the way it's behaving. What's your take on how this whole played out?
Well, Patrick, this was just an amazing week in the crude oil market, because normally inventory on Wednesday is kind of the big story of the week. I've always said, though, that what's more important is not the actual inventory numbers, but rather how the market reacts to them. So with that in mind, let's talk about what happened. Inventory coming in this week with a build of 15.2 million barrels of crude oil. Wow, that is an epic, large, huge, huge bearish surprise in terms of that great big crude oil build. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.4 million barrels. Okay, is there going to be an offsetting drawdown in the finished products in order to offset that huge build in crude? Nope, we've got even more builds. Gasoline, another 4.2 million barrels. Distillates, another 5.2 million barrels. Add it all up between crude and finished products, you've got 24.6 million barrels of petroleum products, both crude and finished products, added to inventory this week. That normally would be an utterly massive bearish signal. So, of course, what happens? The price goes straight down instantaneously and stays down for, drumroll please, about 20 minutes, and then begins the buy the dip rally. And within an hour and a half, it is fully retraced, only to move considerably higher from there. So how is it possible that what should normally be perhaps an epic bearish inventory surprise just gets shrugged off by the market, which trades higher? I think the answer to that question is twofold. Number one, the market really is looking for excuses to look past short-term weakness and focus on the longer-term picture after we get into the vaccine window, when really there is a very bullish story that's building for crude oil. But I think that what's going on is at least some market participants were thinking, as I've been thinking, okay, that's next year's story, but for the next few months, you know, maybe we're really going to see a soft patch in demand as a result of what's going on with the COVID-19 crisis escalating. I think that what we're seeing is geopolitical tension heightening, threats from Iraqi rebels of attacking U.S. assets in the Middle East. They haven't been acted on yet, but just those threats brewing, various things going on around the world. I think what people are doing is they're saying, wait a minute, if there's an escalation of geopolitical tension, that will keep prices elevated through the period where the COVID crisis might have caused demand destruction to pull them down. And by the time that's over, we'll be into the bullish window that everybody knows is coming by the end of 2021. Anyway, okay, let's just buy. And I think that's what we're seeing in the market. And boy, buy they have. I think that the really big move that we saw up today was mostly about the news of geopolitical escalations, Iraqi rebels making threats and so forth. And that's the only explanation that I can put on the immediate move. But overall here, you know, this is really interesting. I get such a kick out of Twitter, Patrick. I questioned our audience. I said, okay, whoever can explain how we got a 24.6 million barrel build in inventory and that still resulted in prices going up, not down, gets a free Macro Voices subscription. Obviously, folks, that was a joke. Macro Voices subscriptions are free. Now I've got a whole bunch of angry people on Twitter who are accusing me of not following through and giving someone a free subscription to Macro Voices. Folks, if you're struggling with this concept and it's difficult for you to process all of the concepts here, it may be that investing is not for you anyway. Just a thought. In any case, Macro Voices subscriptions are still free, folks. Everybody gets a free subscription. There really was nothing to claim there. It was a joke. But those of you who took it differently, best of luck to you.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because gold had a pretty good week up until yesterday, where a bit of a reversal coming off the 1875 level. Do you think that the gold is going to resume a new downtrend, or do you think that bottoms in?
I really hope that we're going to see some more downtrend here. I was hoping before that we were going to get maybe down to 1650 or so, and I really am looking forward to buying more gold if we do get a further downdraft. I think it's about Bitcoin, though. I think that gold is losing market share to Bitcoin, and the big question in my mind is, will Bitcoin break out from its previous 2018 high to new highs? That hasn't happened yet, and it's when that happens that I would expect another wave down, maybe a bigger wave down in gold to occur at that point. So that's the catalyst I'm waiting for. We're already at a point where prices have become attractive again. I just made a very significant investment in one of Marin Katusa's private placements in a gold producer. And earlier in this dip down at when we hit 1800, I added to my gold futures position. So I'm adding here, but I'm really hoping that we still got one more wave down before this correction is over.
All right, let's finally touch on those 10-year Treasury yields. They really have been flat for the last week, hovering still just above the 90 basis point level. Do you think there's still enough juice to punch through 1% at some point here?
I think so at some point. I'm pretty convinced at this point that the bond bull market is finally over. Of course, a lot of people have said that and been wrong, but I think we finally got there. The thing to remember is that if we go way back to end of World War II, when bond yields bottomed, and a lot of people thought, okay, that's the bottom, it's time for them to take off. And it was like, no, they stayed really low for a really long time, like 10 years plus, before they really took off. So are we going to go above 1%? Yes. Are we going to go above 5%? Absolutely. But maybe that's 5 or 10 years off before we get above 5% on the 10-year treasury. I really don't know. We'll see what happens.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Eric, why did we invite Pippa back to the show this week?
Well, Pippa made what at the time seemed like an outlandish claim in the beginning of 2017, right after President Trump was elected, saying she didn't think his motivation for running in the first place was to actually be president, but rather he did that so he could engage himself in a battle with the media in order to set the stage to start his own Trump News Network. Pippa is back to talk about how that prognostication is playing out, because next week, Patrick, is the meeting of electors, which is really a key moment. If President Trump still thinks he's going to overturn this election, he better do something pretty quickly in order to achieve it.
Well, Eric's interview with Pippa Malmgren is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies, which also sponsors my new Smarter Markets podcast, which airs every Saturday morning and explores how markets themselves could be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. My interview with NEO founder Mariam Ayati in the second episode was a big hit with listeners last weekend, so if you missed it, I encourage you to give it a listen. Just type Smarter Markets into whatever app you use to get your podcasts. This coming weekend, my guest on Smarter Markets will be Goldman Sachs Commodities Chief Jeffrey Curry. Be sure not to miss this interview, folks. It's one of the best interviews I've ever done. And Jeff explains why putting a price on carbon is the key to financial markets eventually supporting a climate change agenda, which so many people are asking for in the ESG investing community. Really terrific interview, and that's coming up this Saturday, December 12th. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately.
And it's free, right, Eric?
It's completely free of charge, just like the Macro Voices, unless you're on Twitter and you want a contest and you want to claim your free prize. Just type in Smarter Markets, and we've actually worked with Apple to make sure that they know that you're the guy who won the Twitter contest, and it won't charge you anything.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is former U.S. presidential advisor and best-selling author, Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Pippa, it's great to have you back on Macro Voices.
I love being back on Macro Voices.
Longtime Macro Voices listeners will remember right after the 2016 presidential election when Pippa joined us on Macro Voices and shared with us her hypothesis that President Trump's real motivation for running for the presidency in the first place might have actually been to set the stage for launching his own news network. And Pippa even went on to say that he probably didn't expect to win initially, but of course, when he did win, he wasn't going to turn down the presidency. She told us to watch in the re-election process for signs of a turn, suggesting there was a possibility if it looked like the president could not win the re-election, that he might even drop out of the race and focus instead on launching a news network. Now, what's happened is, of course, we did have an election. He didn't drop out, but already there's been an announcement that President Trump may be pursuing a news network, although he is still adamantly refusing to concede the loss of the election. We're going to focus today's episode on what it might mean if Pippa was right, as the circumstances seem to reveal, and President Trump's real agenda here is not fighting to stay in the White House, but rather drumming up an audience for a new Trump news network. Pippa, let's get an update from your perspective. How do you see the way things have been playing out? Because quite frankly, as I've watched this re-election process, if I try to interpret the news based on the assumption that the president is trying to stay in the White House and continue his presidency, it's hard to reconcile some of his actions and statements. It just doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense for him to be doing the things that he's doing. But if I look at it through a different lens and assume that his real goal is to drum up an audience to create the Trump News Network that you described to us back in early 2017, boy, it seems like every decision he's made and everything he's doing perfectly supports that objective. Is that what you think is going on here? And what do you see next?
Well, like you said, I've been making this argument for a while, and I'm kind of surprised that everybody seems so surprised. Like any politician, if they had half a chance to create a news network, would definitely do it. It's just that he comes from a television background, so he gets the game and how it works. And I think he, like I said years ago, like most candidates, they think they might have a shot at the presidency, but they're not banking on winning. In his case, he was really just having a go in order to raise his, you know, viewership, to literally reinvigorate his television audience, and then he won. And so, you know, what better platform than the White House itself? But that doesn't mean it's the end of your story. I mean, I think what he understands is that having the Trump News Network, a true media platform across multiple channels and multiple types of content, is vastly more powerful than sitting in the Oval Office. So why wouldn't you do it?
I really want to focus on that point, Pippa, because frankly, you surprised me back in 2017. And this is just my own inexperience speaking. You've worked in the White House as an advisor to the U.S. president, something that I've never come anywhere close to. So you understand this, I think, better than most people. But to a layperson like myself, it seemed like, well, wait a minute. If you think of, you know, running a news network versus being the president of the United States, the most powerful nation in the world, to me, president of the United States sounded like a much more powerful position. But you actually told us that stepping out of the Oval Office and in behind a news desk as the head or chief of a new cable news network, you thought that was a step up in power. Is that really true?
Yeah, and I think it's been the case that control of the narrative has always been the most powerful position to be in. You know, I know you've interviewed my father before, Harold Malmgren, and Dad always said when he worked for Johnson, that Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson, used to say, there's going to be a headline tomorrow, and the only question is, who's going to write it? Is it going to be the editors of the newspaper, or is it going to be us in the White House? And you want it to be us in the White House every time. And he was a master at compelling the situation into basically compelling the outcome that the White House got to decide what the news story was. Most presidents aren't as effective at this. They're not masters of media management in the same way. But Trump is, and he gets this. So, you know, let's look at the circumstances. He's got 3 million more voters this time than last time. So his audience has increased. And if you break it down, it increased in every category except for the one people expected. And that was either uneducated or poorly educated middle-aged white males. In that category, he fell. But in every other category, middle-aged black women, Latinos, just across the board, even immigrants of various kinds, he was higher. So, you know, just because he loses the White House, in his mind, that doesn't in any way diminish the fact that he's got roughly 70 million Americans who support him. Now, name a media magnate that has 70 million Americans who already support them. I mean, there aren't any. So, you know, and this is a person who's always admired Murdoch and Berlusconi and, you know, these great media magnates. And I don't know. I thought it was a total giveaway. It was completely obvious that this is what he was going to do. The minute I started to see those meetings that he was holding probably 2 years ago now with Kanye and Kim Kardashian in the West Wing, you know, everybody else is like, what are those meetings about? And I'm like, there's only one thing those meetings can be about. And that is creating some kind of a news platform, because what a combination, right? Can you imagine Trump and Kanye and Kardashian? Are you kidding? Who's going to watch it? Answer, a lot of people. And that's also why I think that there's a chance that he's going to pardon some interesting characters before he loses that power. And I've been suggesting that he might even go so far as to pardon Julian Assange and maybe even Edward Snowden. Because again, can you imagine if he then says to those two, have your own program on my media platform? Who's going to listen? Answer. Everyone. I mean, absolutely everyone. And remember, he's mad at the Washington establishment. He's mad at the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. What would really outrage them is exactly this, you know, and that's his thing. He wants to be outrageous. He wants to dominate, just as Lyndon Johnson did. He wants to create the narrative and dominate the news and not be a victim of it. And let's just add the practicalities in. He's got, what, $400 million in debt, of which $300 million is due pretty soon. He's got the New York State prosecutor, Tish James, kind of bearing down on him. And she's pretty fearless and ferocious. And what's a quick way to make a ton of money? Answer, you launch this kind of a streaming news network, right? You don't have to do it the old fashioned way, which was expensive with high overheads. This is just streaming. And yeah, I think that suddenly he's going to have a whole new empire. You know, he did property, he did casinos, did the White House. Now he's going to do global media.
Pippa, I want to come back to the pardons and a few other aspects that you mentioned in just a minute. But first, I want to point out to our listeners, think back to what happened in the 2016 elections. So many people were shocked that a seasoned businessman who knows how to play the media to his advantage would be so confrontational and aggressive with the media as President Trump was in the 2016 election race. Well, of course, a very plausible answer is if he was not really trying to win the presidency, but he was trying to get more people on his side and against the established media so that there would be a larger market for an alternative to those existing established media channels. It made perfect sense for him to do that. And the fact that it might cost him the presidency wouldn't really have been a concern. So it really does add up. But I want to come back to what we're actually talking about here, because you could interpret this whole conversation a couple of ways. One could be, well, what Pippa is saying is essentially Donald Trump never cared about serving the country. He went through this whole business about being the president of the United States just is a setup so he could make even more money running this big media conglomerate. But there's another way to interpret the prognostications that you're making, which is say, wait a minute, Donald Trump has always wanted to serve the country, something that he, in his own special way, believes very much in. And he happens to understand that a more effective and higher power way of accomplishing influence over American society is being in charge of a news network as opposed to just being the president of the United States, and particularly going from one to the next is a stepping stone to a position of tremendous influence over the direction of the country. And perhaps he's doing all of this because he's just sincerely passionate about making America great again, in his definition of those words. Pippa, which is it? Or is it a third option that I didn't think of?
I think it's actually a third option, which is that those two are not so inconsistent. I mean, just because you hedge your bets and, you know, you're like, well, the White House is good, but if that doesn't work, then a media platform is good too. And you think that you can, you know, lead the country in the direction that you think is correct from either one, right? I mean, they're just different platforms with different constraints and advantages. That's all. You know, I guess your first option that it's a setup, that he doesn't care about his impact, I don't think that's correct. I think he does. And he has a vision of what he's trying to accomplish. And, you know, again, 70 million Americans are with him on that vision. So I just think, you know, he's refusing to be boxed in to only one label, the politician who can only do politics, or the business person who can only do business, or the media person who can only do media. And let's face it, we live in a world where people do lots of things in the course of one lifetime. What's the constraint? Answer, there's none. So why wouldn't you, right? I mean, again, we've seen this before too. Ronald Reagan understood that running a radio show across the nation would be valuable and helpful to him in launching a political career. And so when he went to run for the presidency, he was already known. He was already a comforting, familiar voice that had been heard in American households for, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but maybe 20 years at that time. And so people made jokes about how, you know, he'd been an actor and he got to the White House, but they didn't clock. No, he'd been a trusted voice in people's homes. And then he went to the White House and brought that trusted voice to a new platform. And then when he left the White House, you know, for a period of time before he started to get dementia, he used that same voice in another context. So it's not inconsistent, any of this. And let's face it, we live now in a completely different era with mobile phones in our pocket and social media dominating the way we understand news. I personally think every politician is going to have to move towards this streaming social media space, you know, trying to convey your message across only CNN or only Fox isn't going to work because it is going to get you only half the country. And what you want is more than half the country. So where do you get that other bit? Answer, not on the mainstream news networks. You get it from going directly to the public via social media. By the way, I'd argue too that President Biden, President-elect Biden, is also going to find that the public wants to have more information from him directly. They'll want to hear tweets from him once in a while, you know, because now the public has had a president speaking to them directly. They're not going to kindly take to, you know, plain vanilla, very refined, you know, White House press statements and think that that's enough. You know, people think that politics is supposed to be edgy and exciting and controversial and all these things. And if you don't deliver that, my guess is that public support will start to deteriorate.
Pippa, let's talk about where we are in the process right now, because despite the fact that the media has called this weeks and weeks ago and said, okay, President-elect Biden, that's it. The truth is that the electors that actually decide who's president, which are selected through the Electoral College system, don't actually meet until this coming Monday, the 14th. So it would logically seem to me, if President Trump wants to kind of, you know, push this thing of fighting it until there's a point where it's time to just say, okay, well, I still think I won and I want my 70 million people to be on my side. But at this point, for the betterment of the country, because the electors have already met and, you know, it's time to concede and refocus the rest of my time in office on promoting my news network and the upcoming launch of it and how I'm going to serve the people doing that. Do you think that the meeting of electors next week is significant and that that will potentially mean a turning point in how President Trump is portraying himself? Or do you think that he really is sincerely locked into fighting as long and hard as he possibly can to try to stay in the White House?
Oh, I think he's genuine in his position and wants to duke it out to the bitter end. But I also think that kind of a nasty punch up at the end absolutely suits the launch of some streaming media network. I mean, what better way to launch it than, you know, I'm outraged and this is wrong and, you know, bring the whole public into that discussion. You know, my only question is about logistics. How quickly can he actually create the infrastructure? And I think he's already thought long and hard about that, and he's already got the right people in place. And I'm suspecting it's not going to take very long. And all of a sudden, we're going to hear about podcasts and television programming, and it's probably going to be pretty shocking and pretty challenging. And as a result, everybody is going to watch it, right? So I've jokingly said for some years now, it'll be reality television, but with a lot of nudity, political talk shows with probably a lot of salty language. You know, it will be kind of Fox News with the gloves off. I think that's a good way to put it. It'll be Fox News with the gloves off.
To what extent do you think that it's actually television? Because it seems to me that although certainly for older generations, you know, it's what they're used to, it's what they need to see, a lot of younger generations really don't want to spend time on television. They get their news from social media. They like podcasts better than sitting down and watching something on video. Do you think that this media empire that President Trump is going to launch will be mostly focused on a cable news network, which is television oriented? Or do you think it might be more of an internet thing where it has a video version, but there's also a podcast version and it's live streaming and it's, you know, various other things?
Yeah, definitely the latter. And why would you, you know, in this day and age, why would you create a traditional news network? There's no reason. You don't need all those overheads. Yeah, this will be just an internet-based streaming phenomena. You know, as you say, young people these days, they watch YouTube. And so this is going to be a YouTube-type phenomena. And I imagine, actually, people who watch mainstream media might even miss this whole thing. They'll just not see that it's happening. But anybody who's plugged in on the internet is going to suddenly see the appearance of, you know, all the things that come under the empire that he's trying to build. And I just think it's going to be a whole new chapter in politics. And again, politicians will say, well, it wasn't on the 6 o'clock news, therefore it doesn't count. And they're not going to understand. It definitely will count. And, you know, if mainstream media tries to ignore it, he'll just make it more outrageous. You know, this is a different world where Instagram, YouTube, social media, this is where public opinion is shaped and formed. It's not on traditional news networks, especially since they've kind of abandoned their role as editors, both on the left and the right. And instead, they've adopted sides. You know, they've taken sides. So now you watch CNN because you're on one side or watch Fox because you're on the other. And so, you know, when people are looking for real insight into things, they're going to the net where you have controversy.
Pippa, let's translate that to where the voters actually are, because it seems to me that what little I know about the world of politics is, for right or for wrong, the younger generations don't vote nearly as much as the older generations. So where on one hand, if you were trying to sell a product, I would say you're absolutely got to be right, because social media and online stuff, that's where it's at. That's where the younger generations are all focused. They don't care about cable news. But the cable news people, the only ones that are still watching that, are old people that are also the ones that, at least historically, did most of the voting. So that would suggest maybe they are more important, or maybe the younger people are going to be inspired to vote more than they used to because of the emergence of politics on these social media channels. How do you interpret all of that?
Well, let's not leave to the side the fact that if you create this kind of streaming network, there are tons of opportunities to sell merchandise, right? That red Make America Great hat is going to be sold by somebody. And again, I don't know if you saw the interview between David Letterman and Kim Kardashian. And it was so, to me, so fascinating, because David Letterman is the older guy who's totally incredulous that this beautiful young woman who can't really explain substantively why she has so many followers, you know, he keeps looking for the what's your IP? You know, what's your shtick? What's your thing? Like, why are you famous? He almost asked her at one point. And she very calmly says, well, I, you know, put up a pair of trousers or a t-shirt on Instagram, and then several million people buy it. That is my shtick. That's what I do. And he looks at her like, But why, right? And the answer is, who knows? But she has brand power. And she is quite extraordinary in her ability to just pick something up and look at it and say, I love this. And millions of people go buy it. Now, you put her on the Trump News Network, and she's going to be selling whatever it is she wants to. And I think that Trump gets this. I mean, fundamentally, again, this is a commercial person, right? We haven't really had commercial presidents. In fact, one of the interesting features of our presidents is that they leave the White House and then they try to figure out how to be commercial. So the Clintons tried setting up a foundation. And so the foundation would get paid and then they would get a salary from it. Tony Blair, when he left being Prime Minister of Britain, didn't do a foundation. He set up a consulting firm, and countries and leaders and companies would pay him as a consultant. And that didn't work so well in both of those cases for a variety of different reasons. But, you know, the Obamas, they left power and immediately start doing media deals with Netflix, book deals, which have been very successful for both of them. So, you know, they all try to figure out, how do I monetize having been president of the United States, right? This is the fundamental question. And what we have now is a president who has been in business before. And so his understanding of how to monetize this is, I think, exactly what we're discussing. It's the social media world. It's live streaming. It's linking up with the unexpected person like Kanye. I mean, I asked myself, why is Kanye running for the presidency in 2020? And I think he didn't get that many votes. I think last I saw was something like 56,000 votes. You know, he hardly scored in the rankings. So why did he bother? What was that about? Well, it makes a lot more sense if you think that he and President Trump are going to work together to create some kind of content. You know, and again, it takes me back to those earlier meetings in the White House. I was like, what is that about? What are those meetings really about? And I've been keeping my eye also on some of the people that President Trump has said are, potential managers of this kind of news network. And I remember reading years and years ago that he said David Pecker, who had been at AMI, that which runs all kinds of publications like the National Enquirer and the Sun and the Globe and the World News. And so, you know, as CEO of American Media, it was so interesting to hear President Trump, before he became president, say, if I ever ran a news network, this would be my guy. And then suddenly, David Pecker, what is he doing? It looks like he might be available at the moment. So I'm just waiting, watching to see, is that going to be an announcement? And if I see that those two are collaborating in some way, you kind of know what they're doing.
So just to make sure I understand what you're envisioning, it sounds like you perceive a new Trump network that might be bigger than just a news network. It might be broader in scope, and that allows him to put his friends like Kanye West and Kim Kardashian on their own little platforms that appeal to their own demographic audiences, where they can sell their merchandise and continue to be super wealthy, thereby bringing more and more followership to President Trump's network, which he can use as a platform to continue to press his political influence agenda around his Make America Great Again campaign, or what that means to him and the way that he's prosecuted it in the past. And that essentially this is not just something that's designed to make money, but it's using President Trump's knowledge of business to get very influential people who are profit motivated, the Kanye Wests and the Kim Kardashians, to come and say, look, the place to put your next pair of hot blue jeans is on the Trump network, which is going to make you a whole shitload of money, and it's going to bring a whole bunch of more followers into this Trump network world, which is all online. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah. Like, bottom line, this is about, it like ticks every box. you could continue to have enormous influence. You can continue to control the narrative. You can continue to serve the 70 million Americans who already support you. You can pull traffic away from competing sources of news and information, the traditional news networks plus others. You know, again, I just think this is going to be a model that other presidents also try to pursue. Again, maybe the best example are the Obamas, and they've done it by writing books. And that makes sense because their demographic, their supporters are book readers for sure. And, you know, look, Michelle Obama is filling, she's like a rock star. She fills stadia around the country, you know, that normally are only full for football teams or, you know, for major sports events. And they're coming to hear this one woman talk about her life story. This is an incredible use of media power. It's a very efficient, smart use of it, but very different, right? Because her audience, they read books. Does the Trump audience read books? Maybe not as much. Maybe streaming media that's more reality TV oriented is more their speed. And again, you know, the president kind of treated the Oval Office as the ultimate venue for reality TV. I mean, you could characterize the last 4 years as reality TV meets the Oval Office.
Now I want to come back to the pardons, because on one hand, President Trump would lose face to some extent. He's been very critical of both Julian Assange and particularly Edward Snowden in public statements that he made early in his presidency. So he would, you know, look like he's a little bit of a hypocrite for making those pardons. But boy, if you invoke the doctrine of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, there's no enemy that is a bigger enemy of the people that Donald Trump doesn't like in Washington than Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. And when you first described the idea of the pardon, it took a second for it to sink into me, because just pardoning those individuals so that they go about their lives without being prosecuted, but we never hear from them again, it doesn't really make much difference. But if you're talking about pardoning both Julian Assange and Edward Snowden so that you can give them their own show on the Trump network, that goes way beyond pissing off your enemies. That would be, I think, treated as an act of treason by a lot of people who don't like President Trump, and they would try to do anything they could possibly think of to fight that and prevent him from doing it. Is that the scenario that you're envisioning as a possibility?
Yeah, I'm like, well, what are you going to do? It's a presidential pardon. There's nothing you can do about that. And I do think it's very interesting that back in September this year, we started to see The Guardian in London write articles that basically intimated that political figures from Donald Trump's team began to offer Julian Assange what they called a win-win deal. You avoid extradition to the U.S., and in exchange, you disclose who leaked the Democratic Party emails to WikiLeaks in order to clear up the allegations that somehow the Russians had been backing the Trump team. And, you know, the fact that this is in the press in the UK, that there's some kind of deal, there's some kind of dialogue between the Trump team and the Assange team, you know, there it is. Now, maybe that isn't reported in the U.S. for the reasons that you say. It's just so outside of the mainstream thinking about this issue, which is that, of course, the president would never pardon these kinds of characters. But here we have it in major mainstream press in the U.K. that there was a dialogue and, you know, headlines that, you know, read Donald Trump offers Julian Assange a pardon if, you know, Trump associates offer Assange pardon in exchange for. So I just think, you know, and then to your point where you say that this would really irritate a lot of people. Yes. And that probably makes it an even more attractive proposition as far as President Trump is concerned. I mean, he's been vocal in saying that he thinks the reason that he hasn't won is because the establishment, the intelligence community, has been working against him. well, then what would be the logical thing to really irritate the intelligence community? The answer is what I'm suggesting. So I don't know. I'm watching the news and I'm keeping my eye open for this possibility, you know. And again, when you're creating news media, the more controversy, the better.
So let's imagine a future, Pippa. Let's say it's 2022 and you've got Kim Kardashian and Kanye West selling their wares on the Trump network. President Trump, behind his gold-plated news desk, is continuing to push his agenda, his political agenda, his social influence agenda in the same ways that we've seen during his presidency. Edward Snowden and Julian Assange have both been pardoned, and they are the co-hosts of a new television show which Face the Nation, I think, is on NBC, has lost all of its market share to confront the national government for its failures and its hypocrisy, which Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are jointly the anchors of. And it is an attack on the injustices and bad goings on that occur in the United States government. I've got to imagine that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are a little bit upset at this point. What happens politically in the sense of, does this increase the division that we have socially? Does it further embolden the battle that you see between the left and right that's grown into this Antifa versus Proud Boys and physical violence that's cropped up? Does that get worse? What are the other implications and how does it eventually all play out?
Yeah, let's go back to the Edward Snowden pardon idea, which actually, again, it bubbled up in the international press around the middle of August 2020. And there was a press conference where President Trump said that he didn't know much about the Edward Snowden case and he'd heard powerful arguments for and against a pardon. And then he said, and I quote, "I'm going to take a look at that very strongly. Edward Snowden," right? He says, "I'm going to take a look at this case." And so again, can we really be totally surprised if he ends up doing a pardon here, you know? And would it make him more popular with some and less popular with others? Yes. But what's the best thing that can happen to you if you're trying to create a media platform? Answer, controversy. I don't think he has any hesitation about doing something that just would so completely outrage Nancy Pelosi. I mean, I think that would be his purpose, would be to completely outrage her. So, you know, somebody said, you know, in Britain, they're very big on things like dog shows. And someone said, Trump is like a cat who shows up at the national dog show. And everybody goes, but you're not supposed to be here. You're a cat. And he says, what are you going to do about it? Like, you know, this is the thing. They might say, well, this isn't fair. This isn't right. And what are they going to do about it? It's a presidential pardon. There's nothing you can do about it.
I see the argument that it's a presidential pardon and you can't take that pardon away from Julian Assange or Edward Snowden. But with respect to the Trump network, I would think that there every plausible argument would be made from the left to say, look, this is an assault on democracy. What President Trump is doing is he's using the power that he has as a former president of the United States. He is undermining the institution of the presidency and undermining the efficacy of the newly elected president by trying to, in effect, continue through his news network to act as the president of the United States, even though a new president has been elected. Therefore, the conduct of this news network is an act of treason that has to be stopped. Now, I don't personally agree with any of that, but I could easily see Chuck Schumer delivering a much more compelling version of that speech that a lot of people would agree with. Is there a chance that this all gets shut down?
I hear you, but again, all the more reason to have an internet-based streaming news network. You know, he's not looking for prime time on television, which would require permissions and adherence to regulations, right? This is like you know, this is like Howard Stern goes to satellite. He can say anything he darn well pleases, right? This is using technology to create a space where you can't be touched. So yeah, they will say all that, but that doesn't mean they can stop it. And, you know, I guess the other thing too, is there are going to be a lot of people in the Trump world who wouldn't support, you know, who would view both Assange and Snowden in the traitor category themselves. So I'm not saying this will be universally popular with everyone, but I am saying, again, if what you're trying to do is generate a lot of viewers, you want a lot of controversy, and then this will do it. And, you know, the president's whole philosophy from the beginning has been to tear down the establishment in Washington, to attack the traditional ways of doing things, to undermine faith and confidence in what he argues is like a corrupt structure. And, you know, even if you disagree with that, the fact is he can still make this argument, which is what he does. So, you know, he'll just invoke the fact that he's bringing all these characters together in order to further reveal just how, you know, quote, corrupt it is. And again, as you opened, that's why I think he's making such a big deal out of the election, because as long as he bangs on the it's corrupt, it's unfair, it's deliberate, it's all of that feeds into creating a narrative for his own content going forward. So, you know, and let's also think about this a different way. You know, as you mentioned, I worked for President George W. Bush, and I was very struck that when he left office, in fact, when we started, because I was there on the very first day of that presidency, and he was very clear that when he left, whether that would be in 4 years or 8 years, that his intention was to leave the political stage. He said, when we're voted out, when I'm gone, I choose not to criticize my successors. I choose to remove myself from the political arena. And in fact, not only did he do that, and he was remarkably silent about public policy during the Obama administration. He just didn't say a word. And he became friends with the Obamas. And you see these marvelous pictures of him and Michelle Obama, particularly when you can see there's a genuine warmth and closeness. And that was in part because he just said, it's just, you know, I'm not president anymore. It's not my job. And it's just, it would be disruptive. And I know that when President Trump came to power, President Bush was, you know, not exactly delighted about this, but he did not speak up until it, in his view, things became so outrageous that there just wasn't any other choice. And even then, he was remarkably measured. So we're used to presidents who graciously leave the stage and go about their business, including, you know, even President Obama, who has criticized President Trump, but he has focused the bulk of his energy and attention onto the narratives that are important to him, rather than the tearing down of the president who happens to be in power at this moment. So this will be a whole change, because now we're talking out about a president who's going to go on the attack and who's going to criticize President Biden, who's going to go after everybody in politics. I mean, you know, and I'm not someone who's been a Trump supporter. I did predict that he would win, but, you know, predictions and preferences are not the same thing. And so I'm just here as an observer, right? Someone who's grown up in the world of politics. I've spent a lot of time around a lot of leaders around the world. And what I'm just observing is this is a new phenomena. This is not the typical president who graciously exits stage left. This is someone with an axe to grind, and he is going to grind it in front of the largest possible audience for the most amount of money. And yeah, I think this is, I sort of wonder, how is anybody surprised by this, really?
And listeners, if all of this sounds like crazed conspiracy theory, nutcase kind of stuff, well, that's what I thought the first time Pippa said it 4 years ago, and then the predictions started coming true. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. Pippa, before we let you go, I want to come back to a couple of macro topics, since this is, after all, Macro Voices, not a political show. Inflation, been talking to a lot of guests recently who really think that a secular return to inflation or stagflation might be just around the corner. And of course, the announcement that Biden is likely to appoint Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary certainly increases that expectation. Where do you see the whole inflation thing headed? Is it stagflation? Is it inflation? What comes next?
Yeah. By the way, did you really think I sounded like a crazy conspiracy theorist?
No, I didn't actually, but I did. I was very concerned that you were going to be perceived by the audience that way. And I thought you were probably right, but I did think the audience was going to take it that way. And the audience did take it that way. And we got lots of crazed emails about that saying, where'd you get this lady? She's a nutcase. And it turned out that you were exactly right.
Well, it was so interesting when Trump started to say, as he was losing, that there was that he wanted to create a news network and that, you know, CNN and Fox needed rivals. And I had so many people write to me on Twitter and social media saying, you were right, you were right. And, you know, it was just, it's just, again, it's interesting to me that people haven't registered how very important it is to have a brand name in the media space if you're interested in politics and influence. And speaking of that, you know, I think it's going to be fascinating now to see what happens if Janet Yellen is indeed appointed by President-elect Biden, because Trump's whole position on the Fed was that they weren't being loose enough. And now we're going to see President-elect Biden appoint Janet Yellen, and I don't think you can get any looser than that with monetary policy. It's a clear signal that we are, because, you know, her view is in, at the heart of it is that you shouldn't tighten policy until every single American has a job. You know, you're just going to wait a long, long time before you start taking any of that monetary stimulus back. And so how is he going to criticize this? Because that's exactly what he wanted the Fed to do. So this is going to be super interesting to see the two-step on that one. But I think from a market perspective, that we've definitely begun, we've sown the seeds now for inflation to rematerialize. And I've been really following who else seems to think this, including Warren Buffett, Stanley Druckenmiller, you know, some of the greatest minds of our generation are all going, excuse me, but we have now thrown more capital into the world economy than we did even when the financial crisis happened. And now we've had an unbelievable supply side shock and demand shock. And of those two, which gets fixed more quickly? I personally think the demand happens faster than the restoration of supply. And I think you can see that. Like we've noticed in the last, even the few, last few days, in cities where lockdown has been lifted, like London, for example, you know, it's the first time in my lifetime as an economist that I have seen genuine pent-up demand. You know, it's one thing when you read about it in a textbook, but it's another thing, you know, this isn't demand that doesn't have money behind it. No, this is demand that has been fueled by government paying 80% of wages during this lockdown slowdown period. So people have the money and they want to go spend it. And they basically, you know, out and about doing it, even if there are health risks to them. So we've got an unleashing of pent up demand, but the supply side is kind of broken, right? The relationship with China is broken. Manufacturers, a lot of them have gone bust or going out of business. You know, almost every restaurant has either failed or barely survived. And so I think we're going to see, you know, as people want to go out to dinner, how many restaurants are actually open? Answer, not enough. And so it's a supply side constraint. Now, what happens when you have pent up demand and a supply side constraint? Prices go up. And I think everyone's noticing that the price of eating out in a restaurant is rising. and the price of lots of things are going to be rising. You know, hotels charging more because you have fewer guests coming to stay. And so we need to cover the costs by raising the price for those who do. So I just think, again, I'm not arguing for some, you know, hyperinflation or Weimar Republic situation. I'm not. But, you know, in the past, I argued at the end of the financial crisis that we went from about 1% inflation to about 2.5%. And that doesn't sound like much, but that's a material change from an investment perspective. That is a radical difference for a pension fund in terms of what they're buying and how they're investing. And it's a radical change for a poor family to go from 0.5% or 1% inflation to 2.5% or 3%. Well, if that's already happened and we're already seeing people, you know, lining up at food banks because they don't have the resources, well, what happens now? My answer is, I don't think we can be totally shocked if we start seeing the inflation rate in industrialized countries start bumping up to something closer to 5%. I wouldn't be totally surprised to see it even a little over that. And now that is an unbelievable change from the last 30 years where there's been nothing but downward pressure on inflation, and to have it maybe start to reverse to a level that, again, is material and meaningful and matters to investors. I think one of the side effects is that it's going to mean that equity prices go up much more dramatically than people are anticipating, because they're going to say, well, I don't want bonds if inflation is rising, and I don't want to stay in cash if I've got even a little hint to that. And, you know, where is there the best opportunity to get performance with capital? Actually, companies that now face even less competition than before because so many of the competitors have gone bust. So I could easily see that we're setting the stage for record new highs, sustained record new highs in the equity markets. And that's how inflation works. At the beginning, most people like it because it makes asset prices rise. The stock market goes up, the value of your house starts to rise. Everybody goes, hey, this is good. It's later when the pain of inflation starts to kick in. And that's another question. How long does it take for that cycle to happen? And is it shorter than it was in the past? And I guess my answer is everything else is shorter. Everything else is happening more quickly. So why would this be any different? So it may be that we get a recovery faster and sooner than most people are anticipating. Inflation starts to bite a little faster and sooner, and the cycle moves faster and more decisively than ever before. So I just think these things are worth thinking about as an alternative framework to the typical, we're entering the Great Depression Mark II, so don't worry about any of these things. Because one thing I think from writing about, you know, leadership, and, you know, that's been a hot topic for me in the last few years, is that the moment you feel certain about anything, this is when you're in trouble. What's really important is to keep thinking about a variety of scenarios and testing your preparedness for them. Because in the end, in the last few years, all of the things that we thought were impossible actually happened. And I think we should assume that we might get some more of that.
Pippa, I just interviewed Jeffrey Curry, who heads up commodities research for Goldman Sachs, and a lot of what you're saying here resonates very much with what he told me. Listeners, that interview airs on December 12th on my new Smarter Markets podcast. Pippa, final question I have for you. Back in 2018, I wrote a book saying, look, everybody, calm down about all this Bitcoin nonsense. Focus on the emergence of sovereign digital currencies. When they have governments behind them, that's when you got to really look out for the impact that they're going to have on the economy. Feels like it's starting to happen. What do you see on the horizon?
It is absolutely starting to happen. The Chinese have started to distribute their new sovereign digital currency, which is smart. That's how you get people to use it, is just give it away. I noticed that the outgoing chief executive of Citigroup has said that sovereign digital currency is inevitable. And, you know, again, let me put this in context, because this isn't just about, you know, crypto. This is about a technology change. And I've argued for a long time that, you know, when your debt problem gets so big that you can't pay it off, One way you deal with it is you abandon the system of money and accounting that you've been using and you just introduce a new one. And everybody goes, that can't happen. Like, that's crazy. But it is exactly what happens every darn time. And I've put on LinkedIn an article about tally sticks, you know, these wooden boards that were used for 1,000 years in Western Europe up until 1834. And that was the system of money and accounting. And then they introduced this newfangled thing called paper money. And it was a difficult transition because a lot of people were like, I don't want to use this paper money. I prefer the tally stick that I know and trust and have had around for 1,000 years. But it got introduced and it revolutionized finance and it set the stage for the onset of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you introduce a new system of money and accounting in 1834 and you literally pull a ripcord that leads to massive growth, innovation, uptick in standards of living overall for Western Europe. So today, what is the equivalent of the shift from tally sticks to cash? It's from cash to digital, and particularly to sovereign digital. And I feel so strongly about this that I'm actually becoming involved in a company, which I won't talk to you about today, but I will when we do maybe our next session, that is all about this new technology underpinning how transactions happen. And it will be tied into, you know, what we currently call blockchain. But what it really means is that it will be tied to the sort of digital grid. And so it's the end of traditional tax policy and tax returns and the creation of a world where taxes are taken at the point of transaction. It's a completely new construct. And I believe that as this is introduced, all of our notions of monetary policy are going to be out the window because they just won't apply anymore. And I do think this will set the stage for a repeat of the Industrial Revolution. And that's why I find it so interesting that almost every investor I talk to is, you know, reluctant and hesitating and nervous and fearful. And what I think is quite possible is that actually it should be buckle your seatbelts because we are about to have a period of history that is going to be like the Industrial Revolution, truly historic, truly knock your socks off. And our biggest danger is that we're not ready, right? We're just not ready.
We're going to have the Trump News Network. It's going to be fine. Just relax. Pippa, I think you really hit the nail on the head because one of the biggest predictions of my book, Beyond Blockchain, published a couple of years ago now, was that monetary policy will be the big benefactor of digital currency technology. And frankly, they still don't get it. The central bank guys that are evaluating CBDCs don't understand that the real value is you can design new monetary policy tools, which will make everything that's known about monetary policy today look like a horse and buggy by comparison. They're going to figure that out eventually, and it's going to completely change the face of money as we know it. Unfortunately, my book, Beyond Blockchain, never made the bestseller list because I didn't drink the Bitcoin Kool-Aid and tell the audience what they wanted to hear. You're a better writer than I am. Your book, Infinite Leadership, is I've forgotten how many best-selling books you've had now. Tell us a little bit about Infinite Leadership and where it fits into the other writing that you've done.
Well, that's very kind of you. Well, I've written a few books now, and amazingly, they've been bestsellers and they've won awards, and it's exciting. I find book writing really a wonderful way to interact with other people who are thinking about the world economy. So this one, like my last one, have been very much about why are our leaders failing us? Why do we keep having these terrible leadership catastrophes? You know, why is it that the vast majority of CEOs in the last few years have been pushed out because of ethical lapses? You know, what is the root cause? And so in this book, I very much explain it's not just about organizations and institutions. It's about personalities and people. Leadership is a very personal thing. And the kind of leader you get begins with what kind of conversation does the leader have with him or herself? And this is something people don't usually talk about because they have this view that the leader is infallible. But my view is actually one of the things COVID has done is shown us that the real leaders in our society don't have the title of president or prime minister or senator or CEO. They're quite often just regular people who, faced with, you know, exceptional situations, just decide to make things change. And we're seeing this in so many different ways. And I think it's super encouraging that people are saying, well, I decide to do the following things. And then suddenly everybody's following them. Leadership is becoming dispersed and democratized in the same way that computing power is, in the same way that capital is becoming dispersed and available to a much larger, wider group of people than ever before. So I think it's super exciting that, you know, our leaders are not just that one person at the top anymore. Leaders and, you know, all of us exercise leadership every single day in our personal lives and make decisions that have an impact on others. That's leadership too.
Well, Pippa, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, is a contrarian investment whose returns are historically uncorrelated to other asset classes. Low uranium prices lasted for many years after the Fukushima meltdown, leading to substantial supply destruction. At today's prices, uranium mining is uneconomical even for the world's lowest cost producers. Uranium demand is already estimated to exceed existing supply, and future demand growth is expected. New mines aren't economically viable at today's prices, leading analysts to predict that the price of uranium may need to double to over $60 per pound to incentivize sufficient new mine supply to meet expected demand. The NYSE-listed North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, offers investors exposure to both miners and holders of uranium. For more information, visit urnmetf.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Pippa back. Her insights are always, entertaining at minimum. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, back in January and early February, I told our listeners, look, the market is not pricing a reality. We've got a disconnect between reality and what the market perceives. And I think we have it again. And it's not as tradable as the last one. But the situation is simply, look, this presidential fight, if you want to call it that, is not going to end with the election. There's really only two possibilities here. The extremely unlikely possibility would be if President Trump somehow overturned the election results and actually stayed in the White House. There would be an absolute revolution from the left because they've been told by the news media that it's a done deal. Joe Biden won the presidency fair and square. That would be a huge battle if that ever happened that way. It's very unlikely that it would. The more likely scenario is that President Trump does exactly what Pippa has predicted, leaves the White House, starts this new Trump News Network. And what it means is that the division in society between people who think that President Trump was reelected fair and square and had the presidency stolen from him by shady, sneaky, deep state actors, those people are going to continue their battle with the people on the opposite end of the political spectrum. And I think this is going to go on for years. So I think we have a growing social divide, which a lot of people are assuming blows over and is done after the election results are finalized. And, we know who's in the White House in January. I don't think it ends. Either way, with either outcome, we're going to have an ongoing battle, potentially a battle between President Biden in the White House and ex-President Trump behind his gold-plated news desk at the Trump News Network, both trying to influence the direction of society to their own goals. And I think that could turn really ugly. But moving on to a more positive subject, Patrick, let's move on to the post-game chart book. Listeners, you find the download link in your research roundup email. The topic this week, pause, correction, or crash. What's it going to be, Patrick? Pause, correction, or crash?
Well, you know, let's get into the charts and let them do the talking. So I wanted to first just highlight on page two, just the traditional S&P chart that shows how this market's been progressing. The one highlight I really want to make that is up until now, the rally has been very reminiscent of the July-August rally. We saw that more or less lasted the, 2 full months, and the market just kept crawling higher and higher until the correction kicked in. We are just about 40 or so days into this rise. So it is interesting that we're pausing a little bit right here, but it's one of these markets that at least for another week or two could arguably continue to advance higher. And to highlight that, if we go to page three, what I did was to break this down to a 4-hour chart to kind of look at those intraday futures on the 24-hour charts. And what I wanted to just point out is that even though we had a big down day yesterday, that down day does not really look much different than all the pullbacks we have seen through November and December. These pullbacks that tend to last 48 hours to 72 hours, 2 to 3 days. After the market consolidates, it then just resumes. And at minimum, though, what we have to just identify is that the market hasn't yet done anything outright bearish that that would have even signified a market top. So I just think it is a little premature to already be saying something more bearish. But there are certain things that are catching my attention that suggest that this may be closer to the 8th or 9th inning of this advance. And that's if you go to page 4. And CNN Fear Greed Index is something that a lot of people track as a very good gauge of market sentiment. And what I highlighted by overlaying the weekly chart of the S&P 500 going back to 2018 to present is that you can identify that those extreme readings of greed at the top or boundary do correspond with market peaks. And of course, extreme negative fear or negative sentiment often is associated with market bottoms. And with us having hit the 92 level on the fear-greed index just last week, we are at minimum, we have to identify that things have gotten very frothy. I mean, in the last 3 years, there was only one time, and that was back in January before the COVID-19 period, where we saw the reading go higher than where it is today. So while we may not necessarily have any signs that the market is already rolled over and breaking, we are at least seeing some extreme sentiment, which is suggesting that it's very frothy and mature in that cycle.
Yeah, Patrick, the way I see this is, you know, it would be so easy to make the argument, look, these valuations, if you look at the CAPE index, there's so many ways to say this market's overvalued. Well, look, how many times has it been possible to make that argument in the last 5 days, only to have the market just laugh in your face and march on higher? I think it should be topping, but I don't think there's any reason to assume it is. This looks to me like just a little hiccup along the way. We got to see a lot more downside before there's reason to think the market is doing what I think is long since overdue, which is a substantial correction lower. In any event, Patrick, the divergence between the FANG stocks and the Russell, which you have charted on page 5 here, is really pretty striking. And what I think is, to me at least, very interesting as I look at this chart, there's lots of things that diverged and kind of went on their own new pattern with the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis. There's lots of places you see that, but that's not the case here. We really saw pretty good correlation until really the end of October, and all of a sudden you see this outperformance on the Russell when the FANG stocks are what was leading the whole market higher. So is this a sign that the FANGs are no longer the big drivers of the rally that they were before?
Yeah, and you have to even look deeper than that, because when you break it down and look at the actual charts of Apple and Microsoft and Amazon and Netflix, like these stocks have just been dogging it for 3 months and simply have not participated whatsoever with the huge rally, which really was a substantial sector rotation as cyclicals really took over, and we've seen small caps working. We've talked about it a couple weeks ago in our our chart deck how global and international markets, both emerging and developed markets, have really started to as well participate on the upside. And this trend continues. And to further illustrate the idea that this rotation is fully underway, when we go to page 6, we have the momentum value ratio, which is basically showing the trend of that momentum has been the trade. And what I hear, even though I only have a year of chart here going back to the start of 2020, if you even look at a 3 or 4 year chart, momentum has been the trade for the last 3-4 years and has been a material outperformer. And really, once this peaked out in that September-October period, we've really seen that shift where many of the cyclical and value names have been outperforming that of momentum, which continues to actually get crushed on a relative basis. And so while we are seeing a sentiment very frothy in the S&P 500, and while we see the markets holding up, it really is important for your performance to be allocated into the right parts of the market. Because if you were overweight these tech names, you might at some point start suffering some FOMO from not having the performance that the broader markets are delivering.
Patrick, let's move on to my own favorite topic, which is crude oil on page 7.
Right. And so I just wanted to make the technical observation that crude oil has pretty much been able to brush off almost any and every little correction. I mean, each of these little consolidations we see over the last couple of weeks are almost immediately bought. And crude oil has consistently held above its August highs. And irrespective of these inventory numbers, the price action remains very bullish in the way that it's being accumulated and bulled. And it's almost like you don't want to fight this until we see that they run out of buying momentum on this. Right now, with this kind of a breakout, I wouldn't be surprised if we touch toward $50 here on the next impulse. I think the bigger question will be, once we do kind of see crude oil find its little upper boundary, wherever that will be, will the first quarter of the year see a deep mean reversion where it consolidates? I'd love to hear more from like Art Berman and yourself on that in the coming weeks.
Well, Patrick, this is a very, very important moment, I think, in the crude oil market, because while there have been arguments for there to be some downside because of the COVID-19 situation escalating, if we get a geopolitical escalation that kind of gets us through to the point where we really are into the vaccine timeframe, then I think it's all up from here for the crude oil market. And that's definitely what the market seems to be anticipating. It's not just the front month, it's also the back of curve time spreads, which I follow very actively. My trades are performing extremely well there as well. So I'm happy about that. But I really think that if there's going to be a down event in the market because of the COVID crisis, it has to come fairly soon. And it seems like it's not going to come fairly soon because of what's going on with geopolitical tensions escalating. Now, of course, those geopolitical tensions can de-escalate as quickly as they escalated. So we'll see what happens. But I'm thinking more and more bullishly, and I'm continuing to add to my long position on the Z1, Z2 time spread. And finally, folks, don't forget, Patrick does webinars with great chart decks like this 4 days a week. You can check it out for free if you want to get a free trial at bigpicturetrading.com. Information is on page 8. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode was made possible by the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, ticker URNM, a focused play on miners and holders of uranium, and by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. Patrick, what can they expect to find in this week's research roundup?
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to Harley Bassman's newest article, The Wages of Fear, and a link to the Jeffrey Snyder article, Inflation Hysteria Part 2 WTI. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelt with a K, and myself, at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.